ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Australia's Muslim leaders want the definition of terrorism changed after a group of teenagers was arrested in Sydney this week. Also, bad news for those paying off home loans. Economists predict another interest rate rise before the year's over. And Nicole Kidman to receive one of American cinema's highest honours.
If you look at Nicole Kidman's career spanning three decades, almost four decades actually, it's remarkable because you've got all these incredible films, but she also does all these really kind of bold art house movies.
First this evening, an alliance of Australia's peak Islamic groups is calling for the country's terrorism laws to be changed after the arrest of seven teenage boys in Sydney. Five of the boys have been charged with conspiring to plan for a terrorist attack in relation to the stabbing at the Assyrian Orthodox Church last week. The alliance says the concept of religiously motivated terrorism should be removed from the legislation. But experts point out the label is needed to help understand and combat the roots of terrorism. Catherine Gregory has more.
A rethink on terrorism laws. That's what parts of Australia's Muslim community want after the arrest of seven teenage boys in Sydney this week.
We demand that the government and law enforcement agencies commit to an immediate and thorough inquiry into the processes leading up to the raids.
Ramia Abdo Sultan is a spokeswoman for the Alliance of Peak Islamic Groups, which includes the Australian Imams Council, the Alliance of Australian Muslims, and the Australian Muslim Advocacy Network.
We urge a revision of Australian terrorism laws to eliminate the classification of religiously motivated terrorism.
400 officers from the Joint Counter-Terrorism Team raided 13 addresses in Sydney on Wednesday in relation to the stabbing of Bishop Marmaru Emmanuel at the Assyrian Orthodox Church in Wakeley last week. A 16-year-old boy was arrested at the church and charged with committing a terrorist act. And now, from the boys arrested in the raids, five aged 14 to 17 are charged with a range of offences, including preparing or planning for a terrorist act. Ramia Abdo Sultan says terrorism is driven by political ideology, not religion, and to make that connection is not only inaccurate but harmful.
The use of charged language, such as religiously motivated Sunni violent extremism, by the Director General of ASIO, Mike Burgess, particularly during sensitive times, is not only reckless but also fuels Islamophobia and further marginalises the Muslim community. This approach undermines social cohesion and perpetuates the stigmatisation of an entire religious group based on the actions of a few.
ASIO said in a statement to PM that it does not investigate people because of their religious views. Rather, it's concerned with actual and potential violence. It also said the overarching descriptors of ideologically motivated violent extremism and religiously motivated violent extremism allow for accurate characterisation of security threats. But Rita Jabri-Markwell from the Australian Muslim Advocacy Network says connecting terrorism with religion can actually further fuel the problem.
Calling it religiously motivated actually plays directly into the hands of political groups like ISIS, who want to be known as religious, and it actually valorises and glamorises violent actions as religious. It also plays directly into the hands of racist groups that want to scapegoat and demonise Muslims.
She adds that police actions were too heavy-handed this week, particularly since it involved children, and now many Muslim families are fearful.
If you think about vulnerable children that are out there right now seeing material online that is enticing them towards violence, or if there is even just a parent who's worried about their child, and yet the prospect of getting help or engaging police to help in that situation would be absolutely terrifying because they're putting their child in the way of a life imprisonment.
Josh Roos is an associate professor of politics at Deakin University and specialises in terrorism. He says Muslim communities have faced significant challenges in recent decades, being the focus of increased security and counter-terrorism investigations. But he also says identifying the different causes of terrorism, including religious motivation, is an important part of combating it with de-radicalisation programs.
But we have to be able to label it and we have to be able to act on it when it's identified. Because again, the consequences of not doing so really deprive us of the capacity to understand where it's coming from, but to allocate resources, you know, to these programs.
Josh Roos says at the end of the day, the raids and arrests were warranted.
You've had a stabbing of an Orthodox Christian bishop and a number of other actors found on the apparently in the contacts or a WhatsApp group that were sharing beheading videos. So irrespective of the age, and the age is an issue, irrespective of the potential wider challenges, the first thing that law enforcement needs to do is ensure that the wider community is protected.
Josh Roos from Deakin University, ending that report by Catherine Gregory. More economists are warning borrowers they should prepare for a rise in interest rates, possibly as soon as next month. Earlier this week, the Bureau of Statistics published worse than expected inflation figures, with the cost of insurance, rent and education continuing to climb. Two leading economists now say the Reserve Bank will need to hike interest rates again this year to bring inflation down to its target range of 2-3%. But others are warning higher mortgage payments will be too much for some to bear and should be avoided. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
Inflation is too high, says former Treasury economist Warren Hogan.
It's sticky, it's persistent, and it's stubborn.
Inflation peaked in Australia at close to 8% in late 2022. It's since fallen significantly to 3.6%. But Warren Hogan says that's where it appears to have stalled, still not down to the RBA's target of between 2 and 3%.
We're trying to pull off something that no country's ever done, we've never done, and that is get rid of inflation without a recession, without a bad recession. And that's that narrow path. And it just looks like we're wandering off it. And that just is a signal to the RBA that rates aren't high enough, unfortunately.
So are you saying that we need to have a recession?
No, I don't think. I think we can still get back on the narrow path. And that's why I think a further tap on the brakes from the RBA, maybe 2-3 rate hikes this year, getting that cash rate to 5%, will maybe get the job done.
He says the longer inflation stays elevated, the harder it becomes to lower it to more sustainable levels. And he says there's still too much demand in the economy, with a healthy number of Australians in work.
We can see that we've got job vacancies everywhere. And that's a great indicator of this excess demand in the economy. We can see it with this population surge that's going on. These people are getting jobs. That's creating demand. We have to just take that demand out, soften things up. And I suppose the simplest way to think about it is that business can't pass on their price pressures if the economy's soft. But if the economy's okay, their cost pressures get passed through to final prices. That's inflation. That's the next business's cost pressures. They pass it on. It's really just about creating an extended period of softness, this narrow path that gives the economy some slack and doesn't allow people to put their prices up.
The former Treasury economist's view has been backed by an advisory firm, Capital Economics. The case for the RBA to tighten policy is growing increasingly compelling, the firm notes, adding that underlying inflation is all but certain to overshoot its current forecast. As a result, it says, we now expect the RBA to hike rates by another 0.25 percentage point when it meets in 2 weeks' time. Warren Hogan says further interest rate hikes could push the unemployment rate up to 4.5%. But that's precisely why analyst Angus Coote of Jameson Coote Bonds says the Reserve Bank should not raise interest rates any higher.
I think it's unlikely. I think they run the chance of a policy error if they do that. And by that I mean if they hike rates, they, you know, there is stresses anecdotally. You can hear it, you know, walking around, you can see it walking around the streets. There are shops that are, you know, empty and other things. And yes, the inflation is still technically above, but it is, you know, tertiary education some other things that pushed it higher, which monetary policy is, you know, it's difficult to target those things. So I think that they will stand put.
Warren Hogan makes the argument that overall demand needs to come down. So if you raise interest rates further, aggregate demand comes down, and that will sort out higher prices for things like food and insurance and out-of-pocket healthcare costs and rent and electricity prices. Does that argument make sense to you?
Yeah, but at what cost? Is the economy going to roll into a significant recession? I think there's a very fine balance here of getting prices down. And yes, I mean, you can't forget that prices have come down from above 8% down to, you know, to mid threes now. It is on the right course. Yes, it is bouncing around.
AMP notes that it doesn't think the RBA will hike interest rates again, but concedes another rate hike is now, quote, a high risk. Financial markets have now completely ruled out the chance of an interest rate cut this year, instead pricing in a small probability of another interest rate hike.
David Taylor. The former Hollywood movie mogul Harvey Weinstein has had a 2020 rape conviction quashed by a New York court, but he remains in jail because of other sexual assault convictions. The Me Too movement was sparked by women reporting their experiences with Weinstein in 2017, and some women's advocates are concerned the decision of the New York court may deter sexual assault survivors from coming forward. Angus Randall reports.
The lawyer for Harvey Weinstein, Arthur Aidala, calls it a great day for America.
It instills in us the faith that there is a justice system.
But Me Too activist Tarana Burke says it's a call to action.
Many survivors and those who love and support survivors probably thought that that original verdict meant that there was going to be a change, that it marked a change and marked a difference in how this justice system was going to move and operate. And I think that we felt, and a lot of us felt, that we were on a road to seeing a different America.
New York's Court of Appeal has overturned Weinstein's 2020 rape conviction. The ruling does not make a call on whether Weinstein is guilty or not guilty of sexually assaulting a production assistant in 2006 and an actress in 2013. Instead, it ruled the decision to allow testimony from other Weinstein accusers risked prejudicing the jury. Many of those other accusations were decades old and could not be prosecuted under New York law. Lawyer Lindsay Goldbrum has represented six of Weinstein's accusers. She says the extra voices helped build a profile of predatory behaviour.
It is a step back for the legal system in New York. I think that these women were permitted to testify for just that, to rebut the defenses brought forward by Weinstein's team, that these are alleged acts towards the women who there were charged crimes for were consensual.
Harvey Weinstein maintains his innocence. He'll remain in prison while he appeals against a separate rape conviction in California. That conviction comes with a 16-year jail sentence, and Weinstein is 72 years old. Former Assistant U.S. Attorney Mitchell Epner says there's a chance New York prosecutors will decide against going to another trial.
So in a new trial, the same three people who complained that Harvey Weinstein sexually assaulted them would be called upon to testify again. And that is a very significant burden on these three women who already went through an excruciating process of testifying at the first trial, which is a reason that the prosecutors might choose not to go through the exercise again. Harvey Weinstein is an old man. He is in bad health. It is possible, indeed, I'd say probable, that if he gets shipped out to California, he will die in prison there. So they might decide that that is enough.
The Manhattan District Attorney's Office says it will do everything in its power to retry the case. That may take years, and the women who testified over the 2006 and 2013 accusations would need to tell their stories again. Saxon Mullins is from independent organisation Rape and Sexual Assault Research and Advocacy.
We see all the time, everybody appeals their convictions. And when we see those get overturned and we see survivors having to go through this process again, you know, it makes survivors who either haven't disclosed or have gone to the police but are deciding if they want to continue with the trial, it makes them think, why would I do this? Why would I go through all of that to just go through it all again.
She's a sexual assault survivor. Her case went through the courts twice. Her testimony was recorded and reused for the second trial, but she says even then it's still a harrowing experience.
For my second trial, there were newspaper articles about how I looked and how I sounded and what I did while giving evidence, even though I wasn't in the courtroom. So all of those things that complicate our trials still exist when you have this recording. So, you know, the idea of a second trial is always going to be so, so horrifying for a survivor.
Harvey Weinstein is appealing against his Californian rape conviction next month. He may soon be moved from New York to California to serve that sentence.
Angus Randall. Donald Trump's criminal trial for allegedly falsifying business records to pay people off and hide sordid stories about him has been playing out in a New York court this week. While in the United States top court, another case is underway that may affect his chances of winning the November presidential election. Mr. Trump is arguing in the Supreme Court that as a former president, he has a sweeping immunity from criminal prosecution and can't be tried at the federal level for trying to subvert the results of the 2020 election. Bruce Wolpe is a senior fellow at the United States Studies Centre in Sydney. He told me the case is hugely important for American democracy.
The most important ruling on presidential power since Richard Nixon and the Watergate tapes: is a president immune from any and all acts that he committed in office? And Donald Trump is saying, I have to be immune. I should be immune from anything I did in office. And that should not be challenged because presidents have to execute executive authority. And that's what he wants the Supreme Court to decide.
I understand one of the big issues is the distinction between private acts and official conduct. What's the court been hearing, Bruce?
The court got evidence from lawyers on both sides on that. There seems to be agreement that private acts of a president in office, a president would not be immune from that. But it's the official acts, the official duties. So in this case, when there's an allegation that the president tried to overturn the election in several states and that he worked in a private capacity to do that, not officially as president, but with private law firms, other representatives, he could be vulnerable on that. But anything he does as president, talking to the vice president and what he would do in the Senate hearing to count the electoral votes, he would be protected on that. So the Supreme Court, I think, wants to go into a lengthy examination of presidential power and say, this is immune and this is not. And that has real implications for trials that the former president is facing.
Yes, what would the implications be for those pending cases if the US Supreme Court comes back and says, yes, a former president does have some sort of immunity in this sort of instance?
I think what the court will do is take it back to the lower courts and say, this is our decision, this is what's public, this is what's private. And so the indictment of Trump for trying to overturn the January 6th election, a case pending in Washington, D.C., examine that case and say what's in or what's out. A, that takes time, and we're in an election year, and the election is in November. And so the judge already said it would take 3 months from a Supreme Court ruling to get a trial underway. This may delay that. Can you really have a trial of a former president a month before he stands for election in November? It's a problem.
So would the Supreme Court decision have any effect on the hush money case that's going on in New York now or the Georgia election interference case?
State proceedings are not affected. So New York would not be affected. If Georgia ever got underway, it would not be affected. But it really would. The heart of Trump's exercise of power and abuse of power potentially is the, did he try to overturn the election at a federal level? That's the January 6th case. That's what's pending. And it looks like this timeline is really going to delay that with no trial, certainly concluded, much less underway, before the November election.
What impression did you get in terms of how the justices were receiving the arguments from both sides?
The liberal justices were sympathetic to a sort of blanket ruling on immunity, but the conservatives, and they have 6 out of the 9 votes, it wants to test it at various levels. It means it's not going to be as clean a decision as the 2 lower courts said. No president is immune from what they did in office. We have presidents, not kings. That's not going to stand, I think, as the Supreme Court reaches a final judgment.
And how long do you think it'll take them to reach their final judgment, Bruce?
I they must issue it by the time the session ends in late June, early July. And you see that several weeks away, further delaying what could happen in the Washington case.
Some American polls are showing a fair proportion of Republican voters won't back Trump if he is convicted of a crime. So if this Supreme Court case delays the federal election interference case, how big a boost will that be to his chances at the November election?
The fewer convictions he has, the better chance he has of winning the election. But everyone understands a sex and money scandal. And so the New York trial will continue and it will conclude, and then people will be able to make stronger, sharper judgments about Trump's character, whether they want him to serve as president. So it's still important in that respect.
Bruce Wolpe from the US Studies Centre in Sydney. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, Nicole Kidman to receive one of American cinema's highest honours. Scientists are warning that Antarctica's animals and plants are being exposed to twice as much UV radiation as they were in the 1970s. New research has found recent bushfires and volcanic eruptions have caused ozone holes to extend over the continent from spring into summer. And it's the swift reduction of carbon emissions that will give the ozone layer the chance to recover. Rachel Hayter reports.
After a long winter at sea, animals return to Antarctica in summer and the icy continent bursts into life.
The penguins will all come up onto the beaches and lay their eggs and rear their chicks, and the seals also will be having their pups up on the sea ice.
Professor Sharon Robinson from the University of Wollongong is a climate change biologist.
In the summer when you go down there, there's usually loads of penguins nesting and rearing their chicks, and it's very noisy and very exciting.
She's been working with the Australian Antarctic Division at Casey Station, which has some of the best moss beds in all of Antarctica.
In the summer, the ice melts and whole areas just become really green. You go down to Antarctica expecting everything to be white, and it's a real treat to see these really glossy green moss beds. And sometimes you can even see them photosynthesizing. You can see little bubbles of oxygen coming off them into the water and being trapped under the icy layers in some of the lakes.
But over the last 4 years, summers in Antarctica have become extreme. The UV index has risen to 14, more than double what it was in the 1970s. It's now at similar levels to summer in Sydney, and it's happening because of damage to the ozone layer.
It's very much more concerning if you have ozone depletion in December compared to ozone depletion in September and October, when everything's under snow and nicely covered and protected by that reflective snowy layer.
In a paper published in Global Change Biology, Professor Robinson and three other international scientists have shown while the highest ozone depletion over Antarctica would previously have happened in September and October, it's now lasting through until December. And natural disasters in Australia are partly to blame.
In 2019-2020, the Australian bushfires were so intense that they pushed smoke particles up into the stratosphere, and that meant there were more chemicals up in the stratosphere breaking down ozone.
We don't yet know how Antarctica's penguins and seals will cope with higher exposure to UV.
Like us, they probably have some vulnerability in their eyes. One of the biggest things with humans, we either get skin cancer, and the other big effect of sun UV damage is cataracts.
But it is clear all animals and plants will need to invest more energy into sun protection.
That is a cost to their growth and their reproduction. So if they're putting energy into making melanin, or algae in the sea can make microsporin-like amino acids. So there's all these different sunscreen chemicals that animals and plants are really good at making. But it costs to make sun protection. And living in Antarctica is pretty tough anyway, so I don't think they need any more stress.
Sea ice researcher at the University of Tasmania, Dr. Will Hobbs, is also concerned by rising UV over Antarctica.
Ultraviolet radiation is an ionising radiation, which means it can change your body chemistry. And this is why UV light can cause cancer, skin cancers in humans. It actually monkeys around with your DNA. And animals and even algae and so on are no different.
But he's optimistic about our power to preserve the Antarctic ecosystem.
We have agency here. How much warmer the planet gets, it's not really set in stone. We do have choices, but those choices need to be made urgently. We need to worry not so much about 2050 targets, we need to think about 2030 targets.
A swift global reduction in carbon emissions would give the hole in the ozone layer time to recover, which would lower UV levels for Antarctica's precious animals and plants.
Rachel Hayter reporting. Nicole Kidman is to become the first Australian to be honoured with an American Film Institute Life Achievement Award. The award, previously won by Meryl Streep and Al Pacino, recognises a varied career that began 40 years ago when she played a teenaged BMX bandit. Film critics say Ms. Kidman stands out as a brave and humble actor who's never afraid to take on challenging roles. This report from John Daly.
Which it is?
Well, people eat snails, frogs' legs.
After learning she's set to receive one of the highest honours in American cinema, Nicole Kidman shared a clip of her first movie role in the 1983 Aussie family film Bush Christmas. She says that 14-year-old girl could never have predicted all the talented people she would get to work with and the many different characters she would get to play.
This could become a habit.
What if you can't give it up?
In the same year, Nicole Kidman also starred in the much-loved action comedy BMX Bandits. As an adult, it was her compelling performance in the 1989 thriller Dead Calm with co-star Sam Neill that caught the attention of Hollywood.
What about those people, huh?
She was cast with Tom Cruise, who she would later marry, in her first blockbuster, Days of Thunder. Nicole Kidman went on to become a Hollywood legend of the 1990s in her own right, with leading roles in films like the dark comedy To Die For, in which she plays a woman with deadly desperation for television fame.
My own name is Suzanne Stone. That's my professional name.
The Nightly's film critic Wen Lee Ma says Nicole Kidman is known for her versatility and ability to take on diverse roles.
What you've got here is an artist who has made a lot of choices that said, I'm not going to do conventional safe roles. I want to push things and see where the motions and where these performances can take me. Well, my personal favourite of Nicole's performances is To Die For, which is a, you know, this black comedy from the mid-90s, and she's so funny in it.
By a nose, Nicole Kidman.
Nicole won an Oscar award in 2003 for her role in The Hours, playing Virginia Woolf.
Oh, Russell Crowe said, don't cry if you get up there, and now I'm crying.
Now Nicole Kidman is receiving one of Hollywood's greatest honours, an American Film Institute Life Achievement Award. Now this is a big deal, putting her in the company of actors like Al Pacino and Meryl Streep. Nadine Whitney is the co-chair of the Australian Film Critics Association.
The statistics say that she is only one of 11 women since its inception in 1950 to have ever won the award. So now she's in the ranks of Jane Fonda, Barbara Streisand, Meryl Streep, of course, and she is our first Australian, which is astonishing because we actually do have quite a significant presence in Hollywood. So this is just wonderful for our film industry as well as it is for Nicole.
Despite Ms. Kidman's star-studded career, Nadine Whitney says the actor has never turned her nose up at offbeat or unusual roles, starring in numerous art house productions at home and abroad.
What makes Nicole interesting is that she's not afraid to get grimy. For example, when she was in Destroyer by Karen Kusama. But then she turns around and she'll do something incredibly strange like The Paperboy, which is something you have to see to believe. And then she'll flip around again and she will do under-the-radar roles, lift up other actors and young directors. So she is, in a sense, not only one of Australia's greatest actors, but one of the world's greatest actors.
Nicole Kidman will receive the Life Achievement Award at a gala in Hollywood tomorrow.
John Daly. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Lena El-Sadi, Joram Toth and Joel Kassam. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Since the Bondi attack, and with the death of yet another young woman, allegedly at the hands of a former partner this week, discussion about violence against women in Australia has been reignited. Today, Louise Milligan on the National Conversation, her own encounters with threats of violence, and why men need to step up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.